This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
We're doing a dance that can't be beat, we barefootin'.
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia, and he joins me on occasion to keep us updated about what's going on in the stars. And he joins us today to count down the top space stories of 2009 and look forward to what we can expect in 2010. Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year to you.
It's good to see you. How were the holidays at your house?
Oh, very, very good. How about yours?
Very, very good. We actually took my daughter up to New York City between Christmas and New Year's, and we had a fantastic time.
Oh, great.
To see her face seeing Times Square.
Oh, yeah.
It just blew her mind. And then to see her face watching Mary Poppins on Broadway, where the guy, I don't know if you heard about the show, it really is one of the best shows I've ever seen, but it blew my mind. The guy walks up the wall of the theater and then across the ceiling, and you can see the wires, but he's tap dancing across the ceiling of the theater.
Oh, that's great.
It's amazing. Yeah, I've never seen anything like it. So tell me now, what are you doing this semester? How many classes do you have?
I have my big introductory astronomy class for non-science majors, so it's the second half of the sequence. This is the Stars, Galaxies, and Universe class this semester.
Is that like 600 kids in one class, one of those kind of things?
No. Well, in the fall I had 400, and so semester it's usually down a fair bit more.
Now, what is it like to stand up and lecture to 400 people?
It's very different than before. Charlie Tolbert used to teach this giant class, and I had taught a smaller one of about 150, and then Charlie has retired, and I took over the 400 one, and it was a very different experience looking out in this huge lecture hall filled with 400 students.
Yeah. I mean, it's more of a show than it is just a straight lecture, right?
That's right.
I mean, you've really got to keep the attention of a whole lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's tough these days because students have with them a lot of distractions these days. They have cell phones, they have texting, they have laptops. And in a seminar of 10 students, they're not going to take their laptop out and type on it. But in a lecture of 400, somebody up in the back has no qualms about opening their laptop and
doing some work on
something else.
Or texting. They all text now. Somebody told me that kids these days, Ed, kids in college, that they're not into email. Yeah. They text. They don't really email that much. They text.
I'm surprised just watching students walk between classes, how many are on a cell phone or texting as they're walking between classes.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a big enough dinosaur, I guess. I've never sent a text message in my life on my cell phone. I have a cell phone, but I've never sent a text message.
I don't even
have
that turned on because when they told me what that was going to add to my bill, I'm like, I don't want that on there. I don't want any texting. So what we want to do, you have graciously drawn up this countdown of the top stories, and we're looking at 8 top space stories of 2009 for the world of astronomy, and we'll also look at 2010. So let's start then without any further introductions. We'll start with the number 8 space story of 2009, and then we'll count down to number 1.
Sure. I thought that was the flight of the new Ares 1 rocket. It's called the Ares 1X that NASA's developing as the replacement for the space shuttle. So it first flew on October 28th, 2009, and I didn't rank it higher than number 8 because it turns out that what they flew isn't terribly close to the final version of the rocket. This was a test version. The final rocket that's supposed to replace the space shuttle will have 2 stages and a capsule on top. The capsule's still in development, so they just had a large weight up on top that looked like the capsule but was completely empty. The second stage is still under development, so they had a large tube that had the same weight as the second stage, but nothing else. So what they were really testing there was the first stage, and it was even a scaled-down version of the first stage of this rocket. So it was an engineering test. It was suborbital, but it was important for them to get this data on how this thing flies, and particularly what they were really, really interested in studying was how it vibrates during launch.
Yeah, and all of this, of course, is we're abandoning the space shuttle model of space.
That's right.
Where you fly this bus, big old VW bus up into space and then land it as a glider back down.
Exactly.
We're
right.
Returning now to more of the Mercury Gemini missions where people are sitting on top of a stick of dynamite, basically, and fall back down in the water.
That's right. The idea today is to go back to a capsule on top of the rocket as opposed to a flying aircraft on the side like the space shuttle is. And the primary reason is what's happened with the space shuttle is that as you launch, as ice or more often foam comes off the rocket, it has the chance to strike the orbiter, strike the shuttle on the side. and that resulted in the loss of the crew of Columbia. So by putting the capsule back up on top, anything that falls off the rocket doesn't hit the capsule. So it's much safer putting the capsule up on top.
Okay, there you go. And it'll come down in the water, so there'll be splashdowns again.
That's right. So the original goal, hopefully, was to get it to come down on land so that they could refurbish these things and reuse them. But the parachute system and the braking system to get it to land softly enough on land seems to be too expensive and too difficult in terms of weight to do right now. So it looks like we're going to go back at least for a while to water landing.
And is the next thing also going to be called Ares 1 or Ares 2?
The new capsule is called Orion, and the rocket that launches Orion is the Ares 1.
Okay. So, when is the next test launch, or when do we expect this to go up again?
Not for a few years now. So they've got the engineering. They did it. But the real reason they ran this test flight was that early models showed that this thing would vibrate so violently on launch that the astronauts wouldn't be able to read the instrument panel. The instrument panel would be shaking so much they couldn't read the instruments. So they had to figure out how to put vibration dampers in the rocket so that the astronauts would be isolated from this vibration. And they wanted to test this to see how much this rocket actually did vibrate and whether this damping would work.
We're counting down the top 8 space stories of 2009 with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. Number 7.
So number 7 is actually a non-story, but I bring it up because so seldomly do you hear non-stories in the press, and that is that this big asteroid Apophis that we hear about in the news every now and then that seems to have the Earth in its bullseye is less likely to hit us now than we thought at the beginning of 2009.
Ooh, collective sigh of relief, I guess.
That's right. But not much, because the odds of it hitting us at the beginning of 2009 were pretty small. They've just gotten significantly smaller during the year. So the background story on this is in the early 2000s, astronomers discovered this asteroid called Apophis. And for a while, it looked like its orbit was very, very uncertain, and that always happens when you first discover a new asteroid, and you've only been able to measure its position for a few days or a few weeks. Predicting where it will be years from now is very difficult. But if you've been tracking an asteroid for 20 or 30 years, its orbit is so well known that predicting where it will be in 50 years is an easy thing to do. We can do it with a high precision. So when it was first discovered, its position was so uncertain, its orbit was so uncertain, that it seemed like there was a good chance that this thing would strike the Earth in either 2029 on Friday, April 13th, or 2036, again on April 13th.
Oh, gosh. And
that date comes because that's the date that the Earth's orbit crosses the orbit of that asteroid. So then it was, after more observations were taken of Apophis, it was clear that it would not hit us in 2029. But it would come so close, and it will come so close in 2029, that first of all, it'll be visible as a moderately bright star moving through the sky. It's about 1,000 feet across. I should have said that. This is an asteroid about 1,000 feet across. It'll be visible as a star moving through the sky. It'll be closer to us than the communication satellites that we have in orbit 26,000 miles above the Earth.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so in 2029,
that is close.
It
though.
Is. It's very close for an object that big.
Is that big enough to do some serious damage?
Oh, that's a big enough object that it would do very serious damage if it struck the Earth. It's not nearly of the class to wipe out life on Earth. But if it landed in a major metropolitan city, it could do a huge amount of damage.
Is it along the lines of that thing that hit Siberia back in
the Tunguska event? Along those lines. Probably somewhat bigger than what hit Tunguska.
Wow. And so, that was, in the 1890s?
Was 1908, if I remember right.
And that, how big of an area was that?
That was thousands of square miles that ended up being impacted.
And this would be bigger than that.
It would be bigger than that. That's right.
Wow. So this could potentially wipe out a major metropolitan city.
If it was going to hit the Earth. And let's say, that's right now, the odds are very small that that's
going
to happen.
Well, come 2029, the media is going to build it up. We've been told it won't hit, but.
Yes. And see, that's why I put this actually as the seventh most important story, because when it first was discovered and it looked like there was, that there was some danger, that we really needed to worry about this thing, the newspapers put all the articles out there. They everything ran, will the world end in 2029? And then when it was discovered that it would miss us in 2029, it was discovered that if it passes just the right distance from Earth, Earth's gravity will curve its orbit so that it will come back and hit the Earth in 2036. And so now we know, at the beginning of 2009, we knew that there was no chance at all it would strike the Earth in 2029, but that there was a 1 in 45,000 chance that it would strike the Earth on April 13th in 2036. And 1 in 45,000 doesn't sound like very good odds, but when you're talking about a major event like this, it is something to begin to worry about.
Yeah.
So during this year, astronomers found pictures of this asteroid. They started searching through all these photographic archives. You know, we've got over a century now of photographs of the sky. And at some point, this thing was accidentally photographed in the past, and we just had to find those photographs. And a lot of times, that's a manual process of going to a big drawer full of photographs of the sky.
Oh, gosh.
And finding the ones that were in the right part of the sky at the right time, taking them out, examining them, and see if the asteroid was there. And they discovered pictures of the asteroid taken decades ago, before it was even discovered. Now those have allowed us to estimate its orbit even better, and the odds have dropped to about 1 in 250,000 of an impact in 2036.
Goodness gracious.
And the last thing I'll say about the next thing is there's a very close pass of the asteroid in 2013, and we'll get a lot of data then that will, without a doubt, tell us whether it will hit or not in 2036. So I think we just have to be patient and wait till 2013.
We're counting down the top space stories of 2009 with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. We are on to number 6.
So that was a collision between two satellites in Earth orbit, an Iridium 33 communications satellite and a Russian satellite, Cosmos 2251. So it was the first time in human history that we had a functioning satellite collide with, although the Russian satellite was defunct, it was still an intact satellite. So we had two intact satellites collide with one another and create a huge cloud of debris. So as of September, the U.S. Air Force, through NORAD, was tracking 1,500 pieces of debris from this collision that were 4 inches in size or larger.
And the reason we have to track them is because we sent expensive things up there.
That's
and
right.
People.
And people. That's exactly right. So,
and that stuff will go right through a spaceship, won't it?
Oh, absolutely. Because when it hits you, it can be traveling at 10,000 miles an hour or more. If it's coming at you head on, the space shuttle, in order to orbit the Earth, is traveling 17,500 miles an hour. If you were to hit a piece head on, the closing speed would be 34,000 miles an hour.
So would it explode or go right through it?
It actually vaporizes and essentially goes right through. So...
Oh, man.
Because those impact speeds are so high that the mechanical ability of metal to hold itself together just disappears. It literally just vaporizes into a gas, but a gas traveling at an extraordinary velocity.
So how did these things end up running into each other in the first place?
It's a question that everyone is asking. There's no air traffic control.
Was somebody asleep somewhere at some night shift or?
No. The truth of it is that we don't track the positions of satellites to an accuracy that we would know whether a collision is likely, except for a few very important assets in space, as the Air Force likes to say. So one of those is the International Space Station. Its position is tracked as accurately as possible. And anything that looks like it's going to come close to the space station gets a lot of extra attention. They use a lot of time on radar arrays to measure the position of those objects to find out whether they will hit the space station or not. In this case, the communications satellite, nobody was, you know, it was an operating satellite, but they didn't need to know its position very accurately. And the defunct Cosmos, nobody knew its position very accurately. And so when these two come close together, it just happened that they were headed right for one another and nobody knew it.
Well, now they have to track closely 1,500 things versus they could have just been tracking two.
That's right. And, of course, that's on top of the thousands upon thousands of objects. They're already tracking 10,000 objects in low Earth orbit, mostly pieces of debris from other satellite collisions and defunct satellites.
Who does that?
The Air Force.
The Air Force at where? Yeah. Where is that done?
I think it's done out of NORAD in Colorado. So
people get up and go to work every day. Is that around the clock? Like there's a B shift and a night shift?
Well, you know, it's actually probably a big group. So they have radar all over the world that's tracking these things. So there's a group that does the radar tracking, but it's the U.S. Space Command in Colorado that actually brings all that tracking information together and then tries to predict whether things will collide. And, of course, the reason U.S. Space Command does that is the U.S. government has satellites in orbit that they care about very much, and they want to make sure that they stay out of any danger. And then beyond that, they provide a service to NASA to make sure that the International Space Station won't get hit. NORAD would tell a vendor if it looked like their satellite was going to be hit, but NORAD also points out that the position of the satellite and the debris that's going to hit it is so uncertain that they can't predict with any certainty without spending a lot of time
Yeah, yeah.
Going back and
monitoring. So there's thousands upon thousands of little pieces of garbage.
Yeah.
How many like satellites and communication satellites are?
Yeah, there's about 800 functioning satellites in orbit around the Earth. But over 10,000 pieces of rocket stages, debris, defunct satellites that
are really
up there.
Is a cloud of junk, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. It's a cloud of junk these days, and it's only getting worse.
Gosh. I remember sitting on the porch of my grandmother's house down on Cornell Road in Atlanta, Georgia, years ago. This is like in the early 80s or something, or mid-80s. And she was talking about how the weather isn't like what it used to be when she was growing up. And she said, you know what the problem is? The problem is we're up there. She pointed up at the night sky. She said, we got no business being up there, and we've messed up the weather. We're talking with Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia. We're going to take a quick break here at the bottom of the hour for local news and weather. We'll continue our countdown of the top space stories of 2009 and what we can look forward to in 2010 in just a few minutes.
Last night on The Best Seat in the House, we talked with Executive Associate Athletics Director John Oliver about you.
Call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Due to some violent content, parental discretion is advised.
You think that I can hold on to a dress for 10, 15 years? I don't trust the people around him, and I just want you to have that for you. Put it in a baggie, you put it in a Ziploc bag, and you pack it in with your treasures.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
It's 37 minutes after 5 o'clock in Central Virginia. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now on News Radio 1070 WINA. I'm Coy Barefoot. Happy Little Friday. Let's rejoin our conversation with astronomer Ed Murphy. We're counting down the top space stories of 2009. And without further ado, let us get right to number 4, right? Is that where
number
we are?
Five.
Number 5. I'm sorry. Number 5.
Number 5. On July 19th, an amateur astronomer in Australia was looking at Jupiter through his backyard telescope, just taking a look at Jupiter as amateur astronomers often do, and noticed a big black spot on the southern hemisphere of Jupiter and brought it to the attention of professional astronomers who suddenly realized that Jupiter had been struck by a very large comet or asteroid. And what was interesting about it was 15 years to the day since Jupiter had been struck by the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet that you might remember back in, what would that be, 1994.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
No.
And so is it getting hit all the time? We just don't see it, or is it?
It's certainly getting hit by small things all the time.
Yeah.
What's unusual now is that within 20 years, we've seen it get hit by something big twice. So back in 1994 with comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was this comet that swung by Jupiter, broke into over 20 fragments, and then in that July, over the course of a few weeks, these fragments, one after the other, kept hitting Jupiter and leaving these large black spots. And so this was yet another time that Jupiter has been hit now by a comet or asteroid.
Number 4.
So number 4 was the new missions that have been launched this year. The really important one, the most interesting one right now, is the Kepler mission that NASA has launched to search for planets around other stars. Searching for planets around other stars will go down as one of the biggest discoveries in the last part of the 20th century in astronomy. In 1995, if I was teaching introductory astronomy, I would have told my students, we think planets around other stars are common, but the only planets that we know about for sure are the planets going around our sun. And then that year, astronomers discovered the first planets going around another sun-like star. And as of this year, 2009, we now know of over 400 planets going around other stars.
How are they finding them?
They're finding them. We can't see them directly. It's because the planets are so faint and the stars are so bright.
You see the blinking stars of something passing in front of it?
That's how Kepler's doing it. So what Kepler is looking for is they're looking for the planet to pass in front of the star, and the star dims very briefly as the planet passes in front of it. And then you can sense that there's a planet there that way.
Wow.
And Kepler has already announced the discovery of its first 5 planets, one of which is the lowest density planet. That means that it's the lightest of all the planets lightest in terms of volume of all the planets that have been discovered so far.
So it might be like one of our gas giants, right?
Exactly, yep.
Yeah. And what other missions are going on?
So the other missions going on that were launched this year is the big lunar reconnaissance orbiter that's gone to the moon. It was carrying the LaCrosse mission, which we'll talk about here in a second, discovering water on the moon. But the LaCrosse mission was a one-time smash into the moon, look for water. Lunar reconnaissance orbiter will be in orbit around the moon for many years, photographing the surface in higher detail than we've ever photographed the surface of the moon before. And it's significant because it's the first U.S. big mission to the moon since Apollo.
So, how big is the moon? Give me some way of making this relative to the Earth, like if you were walking on the moon.
Right. It's one quarter the size of the Earth. And I think an even easier way to remember it is it's a little bit smaller than the continental United States from side to side.
Okay. So a few thousand miles.
Yeah. It's about 2,000 miles across from side to side.
Okay. So you could drive across the moon that you see at night, you could drive across that in a car in a couple days, three days.
Exactly. Yeah, you could drive across the diameter in 4 or 5 days, whatever it would take to drive all the way out to Los Angeles.
Yeah. All righty. Interesting. Any other big missions?
I guess, the European Space Agency launched a few big missions, one called Planck, which will study the glow left over from the Big Bang, and one called Herschel, which is going to study how galaxies form early in the universe. The two satellites haven't released much data yet, so we know that they're working fine, but not much has come out of them yet. And then one that was just launched in December but has a good UVA connection is WISE, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. It's an infrared satellite's going to survey the whole sky in the infrared, and one of the astronomers here at UVA, Mike Skrutsky, is one of the principal scientists on that mission.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it is. It's a very neat mission. I think the neatest thing about it is in infrared, you have to keep not only the camera cooled, but the whole telescope cooled to just a few degrees above absolute zero. The whole telescope has to be that cold.
And so it's a floating ice cube with a camera in
and
it.
In fact, it's an ice cube made of hydrogen. They cool it off with a giant solid block of hydrogen that they had to freeze here on the ground.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and then they launch the satellite. But that hydrogen, of course, is warming up. So the mission is only going to last 10 months. So they have to survey the whole sky, and they'll survey the whole sky and then start doing it again. And they'll get about halfway through the second survey in the 10 months that the satellite will be operating.
And it's looking with an infrared camera.
That's right, at heat radiation that objects in the universe are giving off.
What are they hoping to really find?
There's lots of things that show up in the infrared that don't show up in visible light. A really good example are lots of small asteroids. They're much warmer than cold space, but their surface is so dark that they don't reflect much visible light from the sun. And there are a lot of small stars that are so cool, they're not giving off much visible light, but they're giving off a lot of infrared light.
Number three, the top three space story of 2009.
And that is that NASA found with the LaCrosse mission water on the surface of the moon. You'll remember LaCrosse was this mission where they took the rocket that launched the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the satellite we talked about just a second ago, and smashed that stage into the south pole of the moon in Cabeus, which is a crater that's in eternal darkness down there. And threw up a bunch of dust and dirt and rock and ice, hopefully, was what they had hoped. And they had a separate satellite that flew right through that cloud of debris, measuring what was in it. And they discovered that when they threw up these tons and tons of rock, there were about 24 gallons of water in this crater that was 60 feet across.
Just real H2O in a little pool on the surface of the moon.
Well, it was so cold down there that it was frozen. So it would be frozen water ice.
But we broke it.
Well, the whole point was to literally vaporize it and get it off the surface where we could analyze it and figure out if there was water ice there, and if so, how much.
So what's the lesson? What do we take away from
that? The whole point of this one was sending humans to the moon someday. Humans need water. It's very heavy and expensive to bring. And we not only need it to survive, but if you take water, hydrogen, and oxygen and break it apart, you can use it as a rocket fuel. So there's lots of valuable uses for finding water. And one of the ideas has been if these craters have a lot of water in them at the South Pole, if we ever build a base someday, the natural place to build that lunar base would be next to one of these craters so that you could mine the water, turn it into oxygen to breathe, water to drink, and rocket fuel to come home.
Unfortunately, isn't it dark down there? So there's no chance of putting up a solar panel.
No, that's right. So that's why you would put the base next to the crater so that the base could be in daylight most of the time, if not on one of these tall peaks where it might be in daylight continuously, and you'd have to send probably robots down to mine the water and bring the water back.
Billy, get the bucket. It's your turn to go down.
Yeah, exactly.
And the top Number two on the list of the top space stories of 2009.
Number two was the mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope in May. And you might remember that it's the last mission that will use the shuttle to service the Hubble Space Telescope. They brought up a new camera, a new spectrograph that breaks light into its component colors. They repaired an existing camera, an existing spectrograph, over a series of spacewalks that will go down, in my opinion, in recent history, certainly, and probably for some time to come, the most complicated spacewalks that human beings have ever conducted.
Complicated because?
Because in the case of the two cameras they had to repair, it would be very much like taking your big screen TV with these giant gloves on and disassembling the cover and pulling cards out of it, electronics cards, and putting new ones in to replace it, because your TV wasn't designed to be repaired like that, nor were these cameras. These cameras were intended to be replaced, the whole camera replaced, and not have their covers taken off and have their electronics pulled out and new ones put in.
But they did it.
But they did it wearing space suits and giant gloves and bulky apparatus and very strict time. You know, you've got 10 minutes to do this.
Flying through space at how fast?
17,500 miles an hour. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's the one they showed on NASA TV, right? I think that's, I remember emailing you saying, are you watching this?
Yeah.
And you're like, we're all watching it. Yeah, that's amazing. And the top space story of 2009 was?
This was a very big year for very small planets outside of our solar system. So I was telling you earlier that one of the big discoveries in the last 20 years has been planets around other stars. But much to our disappointment, I mean, we're excited by these planets, but it's been a bit disappointing because they're all gas giant planets like Jupiter. And they're, and not only are they gas giant planets, they're also very close to their parent star. So they're very hot gas giants.
Not likely to have life that we would recognize.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're interesting in their own right to study, but we really haven't found any Earth-like planets yet. So this was the year that we're getting closer. So the key thing to take out of this, regardless of what you've read in the paper, is that we have not yet found an Earth-like planet, but we've gotten a lot closer. So the first one of the two planets is a French team discovered a planet going around a star that's called Corot 7. It's about 490 light years from Earth. And the planet is 1.7 times the diameter of the Earth, and it's 4.9 times the volume of the Earth and 4.8 times the mass of the Earth. So this thing's, you know, five times the mass of the Earth, a little bit less than twice the size of the Earth. But what's really important is it has the same density that the Earth does, about 5.5 times the density of water. This thing is not a gas planet. It is a rocky planet, just like the Earth. So this was our first discovery of a rocky planet outside of our solar system.
Amazing.
It is. And now the thing
is, how far away is it?
Oh, this thing's so close to its parent star that it goes around its star in 20 hours. And so this thing has a day that's a year that's 20 hours, 29 minutes long. So this thing is so close to its parent star that...
So it's like a big Mercury.
It's much hotter than that. It's 20 or 40 times closer to the star than Mercury is to our sun. So this thing is really hot. So... Mm-hmm. So there's no chance for life on this thing, but importantly, it's our very first rocky planet out there.
It's out there, isn't it?
That's right.
I mean, somewhere. You think something's out there.
That's the big question, right?
Come on, Ed. Tell us the truth.
Yeah, that's right. But
truth
is
out there.
As we've said before with the Fermi paradox, which is my favorite, you know, I teach a whole seminar class at UVA on the Fermi paradox, is if life has existed in the galaxy for billions of years or had the potential for billions of years, why have they never come here? This is a resource-rich planet, a wonderful place to set up a colony or to set up a location. Why did they never come here? Is it because space travel's so hard?
And I remember you telling me there's no evidence in any archaeological record anywhere that there was any... You know, substantial evidence that there's any real visitor.
That's right. Yeah, we have
people like to think it's there, but they're reading a lot into it.
Yes, and I certainly don't believe that we're being visited today. I do not believe that UFOs are evidence that we're being visited today. I think it's mostly people going out and seeing something in the sky they don't understand. But just because they don't understand what they see doesn't mean that it is automatically an extraterrestrial visitor.
Yeah. So. Well, chances are it's us.
That's right. A lot of them are things that if an astronomer were standing next to you, they would have said, oh, no, that's a meteor or that's Venus. Or I mean, a lot of them are just everyday occurrences in the sky, but seen by people who don't watch the sky all the time.
Yeah. But the search continues.
The search continues. And there was another interesting small planet discovered this year. It's just got a catalog number, GJ1214b. This one is a low-density planet. And the reason I bring this one up is that there was a lot of news made of the fact that it could be a giant water world. It could be a small rocky planet with a large amount of water because its density— is about the same as the density of the moons of Jupiter. And many of the moons of Jupiter, like Europa, are icy worlds. Now, this is close enough that it wouldn't be icy. It would actually be a water world.
Wow.
Now, the problem with this is, and this is why I'm really careful about this one, we have not seen water on this planet. We have only detected its density. It's very possible that it is a Neptune-like gas giant. That's the other possibility. And I think the astronomers were careful to lay that out. It could be a water world, or it could be a gas planet like Neptune. And there was a lot of press made about astronomers discovering a water world or a possible water world. And we haven't seen the water yet.
No evidence of the water yet.
That's right.
There's some inference that that's a possibility.
It's a possibility. So, but what I think the important thing to get out of it is we've gone from finding just the big Jupiters to getting down to planets that are very close to the size of the Earth. And so our hope is in the next, with Kepler, in the next decade, certainly, but maybe the next 5 years, we will start finding planets that are the same size as Earth, far enough away from their stars that they would be in this zone, for the water zone where we are, where water can exist as a liquid.
Yeah. We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy, the top space stories of 2009. And in case you're joining us late, this will be available as a podcast at WINA.com. And remind us, I don't think we're going to have time for the top space stories of 2010. So if it's possible, we could get you back in here.
That's fine.
And we'll preview 2010 and all the big space stories that we need to be focusing on this year.
That's fine.
And we'll do that real soon. But remind us, you were talking about the planets, the moons around the other planets in our solar system. And we've talked about this in the past. And I think this is what interests me the most, just as a pedestrian person who's just interested in this stuff. I'm so fascinated by some of these icy planets.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, these icy moons.
That's right.
Tell us now, Europa is one, Io is another, there's a strong probability that we could find life on these things, right?
Well, I wouldn't say strong probability. I would say there's a possibility that there could be life there.
See, so, you would say possibility, and I'd say strong probability.
Yeah, so, and the difference
that's
is...
That's the difference between us.
Yes, that's
and
right.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you know, Europa is the ideal world. When you look at Europa, it's an icy planet. The ice is cracked, and we see that there's something gushing up between the cracks that are filling them in and freezing. And the spacecraft that we've sent around Europa indicate that underneath that icy layer, which could be 12 miles or 20 miles thick, there's a liquid water ocean underneath there. And in my opinion, that is the place in the solar system where we should be exploring. We should be building right now a robotic satellite to go spend all of its time investigating Europa. So,
is anybody working on that?
It was in the budget, but it was cut out of the budget because of the budget problems that NASA is having right now. So a Europa Explorer is still seen as a very high priority at NASA. It's just not being built right now. It's not being worked on.
What a shame, because that is the most, everything that's on the table right now, that's the most likely place right now in our solar system to find other life, right?
That would be my opinion. That's right. People who study Mars might argue that Mars is as good a location because Mars was clearly wet in the past, and we don't know what's going on underground on Mars. There could be liquid water aquifers underground on Mars. So it's either Mars or Europa, and we are doing a lot on Mars right now. So this upcoming year, we will see the launch of a new rover to Mars, the new Mars Science Laboratory.
What's the latest on those, I almost said guys, those two guys on Mars, you know?
That's great. I'm glad that you think of them. I mean, they're doing just what humans would do, but they're doing
walking
it.
Around, exploring, testing materials.
That's right. So Spirit is, there's two of them, Spirit and Opportunity. Opportunity is working just fine, and it's driving towards the biggest crater that human beings will ever have explored on another world, and it might get there in a year or so. It's
how
a long
big relative
way
to the Earth is there?
So it's a couple miles across. So this crater that it's going to go visit.
Holy
cow! Yeah. So it's a huge crater. Spirit, on the other hand, is stuck and has been stuck for many months. And the more time that goes by, it's looking grimmer and grimmer for Spirit right now.
So, really?
Yeah. One of Spirit's motors, its wheels stopped operating a few years ago. They got stuck in this sand. Another wheel stopped operating. So now out of the six wheels, they've only got four that are fully functional. That's hard enough to get out of this sand that they've gotten it stuck into, or that it got itself stuck into. But there's other issues. There's a rock underneath, and it may have settled down on top of the rock. So that means the wheels aren't pushing down with their full force. And to top it all off, winter is coming. The sun is getting lower and lower in the sky, and Spirit can't move to position its solar rays so that they point at the sun to recharge its battery. So as this winter arrives, if they don't get Spirit unstuck, it may be the end of the Spirit.
Is there
mission.
Anything interesting around it that they can do?
Though they, if it survives the winter, there's lots of interesting science that they can do just where it's sitting now by using. It's got this little arm, and it can measure the soil that it's sitting on. It can measure things that are in its immediate vicinity, do lots of photography of the area. But the real hope is that they could get it out and get it moving again.
And there were no, we're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. We did find water on Mars, right?
That's right, with the Mars Polar Lander. So, and Mars Polar Lander was last heard from in November of 2008. Coming up in a few weeks here, the Martian winter up on the North Pole has ended. Spring has arrived. It should be defrosting. And so NASA is actually going to listen to signals to see if the Mars Polar Lander has woken up and has revived itself. Everyone thinks the odds of that are slim. Nobody's really holding out hope that it will, but it would be a truly amazing if this thing survived.
Well, look what those other two guys did.
That's right.
They were sent there for
90 days, 3 months was their primary mission, and they landed in 2004. They're still operating now 6 years later in 2010.
That's got to be one of the greatest success stories in space exploration.
I think it will go down.
And it really does make you have to go back and reevaluate your expectations for when you send these things.
Yeah. Now, the difference between the rovers is the rovers have been continuously on the whole time, without a doubt, because the Mars Polar Lander was in complete darkness for 6 months up on that North Pole of Mars. So it completely shut down, and it completely froze solid. So that's the question, is can this thing defrost? Will all the electronics have survived? Will it wake itself up and call home?
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia. He will join us again very soon, as we can schedule it, to preview the big space stories of 2010. Ed, thank you so much.
Oh, sure. Really, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break for CBS News, local news, and get a weather update. We're back with Best Seat in the House. Stay tuned. Y'all have a great night.
Last night on the Best Seat in the House, we talked with Executive Associate Athletics Director John Oliver about you, the fans.
But the big thing, this whole thing right now, is about getting behind this team as they try and find a way to make a dent in this season and to grow the program for the long term. I think the fans are a very critical part of that.
Join us tonight at 6. We'll hear from Leonard Sanders, Jerry Radcliffe, John Oliver, all on the new president. What will her approach be to athletics? Plus, defensive coordinator Jim Reed from the football team tonight on WI.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.